Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Dr. Jerry Bergman, he's taught biology, genetics, chemistry, biochemistry, anthropology, geology, microbiology at the college university level for 40 years. He has over 1,000 science publications to his credit, many of them translated in up to 12 different languages. Today, we're continuing our discussion with Dr. Jerry Bergman on his book, How Darwinism Corrodes Morality. Dr. Bergman, thank you for continuing this.
It's great to be here.
So how about the role of Darwinism and the advocacy of abortion?
Yeah, very, very profound role. And did a lot of research on this. In fact, one of the chapters in the book is devoted to this. And the Human Life Review, they also published my article on the relationship between Darwin and abortion. And what I found was that one strong argument they used was the fact that when an abortion occurs, the child is at the stage where it's a fish. In other words, what he did, the argument he used, and this, by the way, was a head of the Department of Genetics.
This is Haeckel's embryos.
At the University of Michigan, he used Haeckel's embryos, and he said, basically, we start out as a one-celled creature like an amoeba, and then we go through the different evolutionary stages. And during the stage, we're in the fish stage, the fish time of our development, that is when abortion usually occurs. And so you're not killing a child, you're killing basically a fish. And he argued not just it's a fish, it has gill slits like a fish, it has gills like a fish, it has the traits of a fish. And now we know that's based on Haeckel's embryos, Ernst Haeckel, who was a German biologist, and he obtained these pictures by drawing. And he drew according to what he claimed he saw through the microscope. Well, there's no way that that would be because we know his drawings were way off. And later on, when he was confronted with this, he said, well, a little bit of artistic license. I just tweaked them a little bit to make the point stronger. Well, he didn't just make the point stronger. He basically was dishonest in preventing these embryos, which is an ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which these drawings have been in textbooks for 100 and some years. So these were used as in the Supreme Court case, and the judges were very impressed with this argument. They thought, well, it's a piece of tissue. It's a fish. It's not a live human being, so it's not killing a human because it's not at this stage a human. Therefore, this weighed in fairly strongly into their arguments. And this can be, well, my chapter covers the many references, but it's fairly clear that this impressed the judges. I think today, if this were brought, the same case were brought to the Supreme Court, I feel it'd be a very different outcome, partially because now we have ultrasound, not just ultrasound, but color, good, clear ultrasound pictures. Mm-hmm. So you can see during these early stages, it indeed is a child. It's not a fish. It's a child. And this, by the way, has been one of the most convincing ways of helping young girls who are pregnant not abort their children. You show them a picture, an ultrasound picture of a fetus, and right away they look at it and they say, it's a child. Hmm. I can't abort this. It's not a fish. It's not it's not a piece of tissue. It's a child. And in fact, many pro-life clinics that help women with this issue, one of the most important things they can have is an color, high quality ultrasound. And they take a picture and, you know, who can turn down a picture? Well, it's a picture of your child. Let's just lay down and I'll get a picture. No pain, no problem. And here's the picture. There's your child. And this has a profound effect on them. In fact, this is one of the main ways you can convince a woman not to have an abortion.
Ernst Haeckel, back in 1907, I have a little clip on our article on him. It's from the New York Times. And it says, this was on page one. It says, Kaiser honors Haeckel, bestows the title of excellency on this famous atheist. And it's just a hysterical thing. Let me read this short quote to you, Jerry. Emperor William today bestowed on Professor Ernst Haeckel, the celebrated Darwinian and founder of the Association for the Propagation of Ethical Atheism, the title of Excellency. Yeah. So it's the Association for Ethical Atheism, and he commits this fraud. in these drawings, which were even challenged at the time.
Yeah. And not only that, but when he drew pictures, or when he had drawn, I think he drew a lot of himself. He was really a good artist. There's no question he was an incredibly good artist. But some of the pictures he drew of African-Americans or Africans look very much like monkeys. In fact, even back then, there was so much outcry that he finally had to redo the drawings in order to not only of the African-Americans, but also of the precursors of the African-Americans. And that I cover in one of my books as well as one of my articles, which talks about this problem.
Well, that's similar to the Scopes Monkey Trial, Hunter's Civic Biology. That text listed blacks and Jews as just above the apes.
Yeah.
And so when the Christians in Tennessee were objecting, they saw the objectification of human beings, specifically these minorities, as though they were animals.
Yeah.
And they were right in opposing that, of course.
Right.
There's a fabulous film, a new film on the Scopes Monkey Trial. It's called The Ledged. We highly recommend it. Major Hollywood actors, great. It tells the true story of the Scopes Monkey Trial.
Yeah.
Jerry, in one of your chapters, Social Darwinism Leading to Murder, you have the cases of Charles Manson and that Dutch guy who went on the island and shot up all those kids, Anders Behring Breivik.
Right. No, he's Norwegian.
Norwegian.
And he has a manifesto which he wrote, which was, I don't know, about 900 pages. It was huge. I read the whole thing, and boy, it is very, very clear that his concern was eugenics and the inferior races. He had a hard time with these inferior races interbreeding with Norwegians. And his major concern was we need to stop this because we are causing the superior race to become mongolized and become inferior. We're causing the degeneration of the superior Aryan race is what he was concerned about.
Which was the social Darwinism of the Nazis.
Exactly. And he mentions that. He mentions that Hitler got a bad rep, but he had some good ideas. Namely, we need to ensure that the superior race does not interbreed and thus mixes with the inferior and thus producing children that are inferior. He felt that if you have a superior, let's say a 10, as far as superiority is concerned, and a 5, you'll never get a 10. You always will cause the offspring to be less superior to the most superior of the couple. And instead of being, you know, they might not be 5, so they might be 6. A 10, of course, would be an Aryan, and a 1 would be, I guess, a Negro. And so, therefore, he was very concerned about that. And he was really quite articulate and was able to explain his views quite well, but openly involving, of course, eugenics. And what bothered me is they keep calling him New Right, and he was...
And they said he was a Christian.
Politically right and a Christian and a fundamentalist and
By
so
Christian,
on.
They meant not Muslim.
Well, yeah.
Or European.
And that wasn't true at all. He was... No. He actually goes into a lot of detail on what he would feel, what he expected to feel when he would shoot all these people, but he felt it was doing it for a good reason, that we need to make a point, and the point is we need to reduce the degeneration of the superior race, and to do that, we need to basically adopt some of the Hitlerian ideas, and I don't think he was very successful in what he did. He killed, 76 people, I think?
Yeah, he went onto that island with all teenager students. And just ran all over the island, gunning people down.
And recently I read a story in one of the newspapers about him. He's complaining about his difficulty in prison. He has a 3-room prison. He has a nicer apartment than many people have in New York City. 3 rooms. I have pictures in the web of his apartments. And he had a computer. He had video games. He had a lot of stuff to do, and he complained, I get lonely, I don't have anybody visit me. Well, I can see why. And his family even didn't visit him, and well, I can see why as well, why they didn't visit him. But I guess he's only had like 1 or 2 visitors. He had a couple of marriage proposals, ironically, but he complained how awful the conditions were, and I'll tell you, 80% of the world's population don't live in conditions as nice as he was in.
After the Columbine Massacre, which was just down the street here, the Rocky Mountain News, on page 1 of a 1999 article, after the autopsies came out, one of the murderers had a T-shirt on that said natural selection.
Right.
And the Rocky Mountain News actually wrote this. They said that we don't know what that phrase referred to.
Well,
they actually wrote that.
Yeah, that's hard to believe. I would say that's not ignorant so much as trying to distort what happened. Because that's I would say most third graders are aware of natural selection and what that means.
Well, of course, they just didn't want to suggest that they believed in survival of the fittest and evolution.
Right.
They didn't want to. That was it. Maybe it was some grunge band or something they were hoping. So then Charles Manson.
Yeah, that surprised me because I had no idea that he was influenced by Darwinism and Darwinian ideas. But I'm not sure how I come across this, but somebody mentioned he was, and I thought, oh, that's no, not Charles Manson. That's ridiculous. But as I read more and more, I realized that his whole concern was that the inferior race, he thought blacks were inferior.
He was trying to start a race war.
The inferior race would take over, and they would not do so well because they were inferior. And then he felt the white race would be able to overpower the inferior race, and then things would be right again. Things would be the way it should be. And he got to the extent where I guess he had a lot of guests to his ranch, where he, Spandau Ranch, I believe it was, where he and his group, his family lived. One part of the group was a Hispanic gentleman who was also a motorcycle enthusiast. And he would not let him become part of the group because he was Hispanic. And I thought, this is just hard to believe that such a man as him, who was certainly not an ideal value, would be this racist. And clearly he was very, very racist. Mm-hmm. And this is the idea of Helter Skelter, that indeed the race war would occur and the blacks would take over for a while, but they would not be able to retain their rulership because they were inferior and the whites would eventually take over. And he was hoping that his group would be the one that would help take over from the blacks after they took over from the whites. Hmm. It's absurd when we think about that, but a lot of this came out in the court testimony. In fact, as I read the court testimony, they explained what they thought was happening and what he predicted, the helter-skelter idea would occur in the future and how they were going to basically save the world by their group, which, of course, is ranting of, we would say, a madman. But on the other hand, I'm surprised at how imbued he was in the ideas of Darwinism.
Some of his gang, the murderers, later turned to the Lord in prison. I think Tex Watson, we went to visit Susan Atkins in the California Women's Penitentiary back in 1978, my friend and I, and asked her to send a letter, which she did, a handwritten letter, to his wife, estranged wife. She had gotten into Satanism. And she wrote a beautiful 3-page letter pleading with this young woman to not destroy her life. Really awesome.
I didn't know that. That's
so even an iconic case like Charles Manson and Helter Skelter, even that you can trace its roots to these belief systems. Of course, people who believe in the Lord or claim to believe in the Lord have done evil things, but the teachings of Jesus Christ condemn what they do.
Right.
Whereas when someone believes in atheistic survival of the fittest, you can't condemn the Nazis on Darwinism. You can't do that. There's no standard by which you could condemn the slaughter of organisms that you think are inferior.
Uh-huh.
It's just your preference.
Yeah.
You write also about Dr. Spock.
Yeah, he had produced, of course, the Baby and Child Care book. It was one of the most successful books ever, period, and one of the most successful in the area of raising children. Mm. And in one of his books, his first part, he talked about the evolution in the womb, and we evolved from, again, the Haeckel's idea. And that surprised me that he would include this. Now, that's the only hint of evolution he has in the entire book, but it surprised me that he would uncritically quote this section, since he went to Yale. I mean, he was a bright student. He did very well in school. He was very articulate, and so many of his ideas were very well put. It surprised me that he would stoop to that tautology, recapitulate phylogeny, and that create that fish embryo story, and it just...
The fish gills. The embryo has fish gills. That is one of the icons of evolution. It's too big to fail. And if you think about the absurdity, when you're developing a brand new organism, so you have a little embryo, a zygote, an embryo, resources are precious.
Yeah.
And you're going to waste time and nutrients and opportunity to look like a fish and to look like a reptile and to look, it's absurd. The concept is absurd. Also, the mechanism. How would the organism evolving remember what it looked like 80 million years ago? It's so bizarre.
Right, it is.
Yeah.
This was found in not only its first edition, but other editions. And that surprises me that people didn't write in and say, look, this is only a couple of paragraphs. Take it out. It has nothing to do with really what you're talking about in this section. And furthermore, there's a problems with it. And
he dug in.
I know he never took it out.
Well, he led the jihad against spanking. And either Dr. Spock was right or the scriptures were right, because the Bible counsels parents to spank their children, to discipline their children. And so he really, it was this war, this jihad against spanking, and millions of children have paid with miserable childhoods. There are kids who cry through most of their childhood.
Yeah. Yeah. What happened, of course, was that people interpreted that beyond even what Spock had, and they ended up becoming very permissive parents. And we don't want my child to fail, don't want him to do things that could be a problem. Well, of course we don't. But on the other hand, as they say, the best teacher is experience. It's not the most economical one, but in many ways it's the best teacher. I had a student a few years ago actually mention that he had a hard time teaching his son things like hot and just didn't get the idea. So finally he thought, well, I'll let the child touch the burner, you know, not to burn himself seriously, but I'll let him touch the burner and then explain that's hot. And he touched the burner, and boy, it was very painful.
Yeah.
He didn't get a third degree burn, but probably a second degree burn.
Oh.
And he didn't force the child to do this. He just let the child do this and said, well, let him do it. Now, from then on, he said, when I say hot, boy, he flinched, and boy, he did not do what I did not want him to do. So I said, that's hot. Don't touch it. He just backed right away.
And, you know, when parents can't get their kids to obey just by their voice request, a little kid, a four-year-old kid, is running out after a ball to the street, and the parents yell, stop, and the kid doesn't obey. He never obeys.
Yeah.
And so some kids literally get killed because of this permissiveness and this jihad against spanking.
So sometimes the experience can be a very, very good teacher.
Yes.
And tricky in some areas. You don't want the child to be hurt, but on the other hand, some pain every now and then can be a very good experience. Mm. And when the child has, sir, like illnesses, eating too much candy, I remember when I was a kid, I had a friend who was good with his money, and he took me out to a candy store and bought $5 worth of candy, and I sat there and ate it all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was, I don't know, like 5, 6 years old, and really got sick. That was a very important lesson I'll never forget. And therefore, when I look at abusing my body by eating too much of candy, for example, I say, wait a minute, I've had 2 pieces, that's enough. Mm. So it turned out to be a good thing for me, even though I sure didn't like being sick and throwing up. And
Dr. Bergman, your book, How Darwinism Corrodes Morality, you even write about the church supporting eugenics, which is so horrific. Eugenics flowed directly from Charles Darwin. Was it his first cousin, Galton, I think? It was
his first cousin, yeah.
Well, the father of the eugenics movement.
Right.
And so the church, I know that in Germany, the Lutheran Church has great shame upon it for not fighting to oppose National Socialism.
Right, Hitler, right.
Yeah. So when you mention the church support for eugenics,
I try to point out that indeed the church is all too often too incredulous about what goes on around them. And we have fads that come up, and the fad I'm talking about here is eugenics. When that fad swept over society, the church ended up not only some churches, and of course not all, but some churches ended up not only supporting that, but several ministers made that their chief ministry goal was to go around and push eugenics. And now, of course, it's embarrassing to read what they did, but indeed, many were very supportive of eugenics, partially because they felt, well, Darwinism is true. These scientists, they're smart. They really know what they're talking about. They teach at Harvard. They're bright people. So they say that evolution's true. If evolution's true, eugenics is true. Therefore, we should not fight science, but we should embrace science. After all, God is the author of not only the Bible, but also of science. And they ended up being very active in the eugenics movement. And today, of course, that's an embarrassment to many, but now there's a new movement that does about the same thing. It's called Darwin Sunday, where they celebrate Darwin's birth, and they base, or for the publication of his Origin of Species book in 1859. And we have relatives that invite us to Darwin Day celebration at their church once a year. And that just amazes me. They could not be aware of what Darwin taught.
Well, this eugenics, often it's hand in hand, or it's part and parcel with racism. And sadly, in Germany, we've done a couple shows on Martin Luther's intense racism against the Jews.
Yeah.
So Germany was fertile ground for National Socialism and Social Darwinism.
Yeah, it was.
It was ripe for it.
And not just Germany, but the United States. In fact, at the Nuremberg trials where the Nazi criminals were tried, they quoted U.S. Supreme Court case with a Buck versus Bell, where they basically said, look, we were just applying what your Supreme Court ruled. Now, how can you bring us to court in this court system and claim we have committed crimes against humanity when your own court condoned what we're doing? Well, of course, the Germans went beyond what the court condoned. But nonetheless, this was one of their strong arguments that they indeed were just following what the American court ruled.
Forced sterilization here in the U.S. I forget the number. It might have been about 30,000 people.
About close to 60,000.
60,000 people. Forced sterilization with, you know, widespread support. So the things that we do in the name of science that are immoral, the culture is easily deceived into thinking, well, if this guy has a PhD from Stanford, this must be good. It must be right. But science, the laws of science, they don't use the words right and wrong. The laws of physics, do they present morality? I don't believe so.
Well, no, of course not.
Right. Dr. Bergman, how about the attempt, and this is painful even just to say, but the attempt to prove that Jews were inferior by their skeletons.
Yeah, this amazed me when I read this. What they were trying to do was develop a museum display to show that Jews were inferior. And so what they did was they took, and I don't remember how many, there are 30 or 40 living persons. They murdered them. They took the flesh off their body, and they shipped the bones to Berlin, I believe, and they were hoping to show that they were inferior by the bones. Well, they couldn't, because there was no significant difference between the bones of a Jew and the bones of a not Jew. In fact, what I find interesting was that the supposedly inferior race, why do they have to wear the Star of David? I mean, if they're inferior, you'd look at them and you'd see they're inferior. I mean, why do you have to? It's like saying, I'm in part of an inferior race. Why do you have to say that? Well, that's really what it meant when they wore the Star of David, that indeed that indicates they're inferior race. So, and this was toward the end of the war, but what they're trying to do was they thought they'd win the war. And when they won the war, then people go to the museums and show all these skeletons, this inferior race, and we eliminated this. We helping humanity by reducing, and in this case, eliminating the inferior race. So, but this is what they were like. So it'd be kind of a display of what used to be around. The people that used to be around, well, they did, I don't remember, had 15 or 20 skeletons. They were discouraged because they just were not, they couldn't point to anything that would indicate they're inferior.
Well, the Darwinists, they would measure cranium dimensions and try to predict who's going to be a criminal.
Exactly. And they couldn't find any cranial differences. They couldn't find any differences.
A lot of these are juvenile ideas. In Darwinism, when you analyze it, an enormous part of the argument for evolution is juvenile.
Yeah. Well, but they really believe that Jews are inferior. And so that what they said, well, let's don't use German Jews. Let's go to Poland. We'll get Polish Jews. Maybe they will be inferior. And they ended up basically having to give up. Of course, the war pretty much ended by this time, but they couldn't really get any clear evidence, skeletal evidence, that would show indeed that Jews were inferior. And now we see it's brutal that they killed. In fact, they have pictures of the person alive, and then when he was killed, and then when he was defleshed, and then when his skeleton was displayed. So it's just horrible what they were doing to try to prove inferiority, which, of course, they couldn't do. I thought that was interesting because it's so blatant what they were trying to do. And they were so disappointed that they, maybe we get some other group of Jews and we'll get some evidence of inferiority. We'll try this other group of Jews. And towards the end of the war, then, of course, they couldn't do that. And so they never achieved it. And we know that they never could achieve it. It's not going to happen because skeletal-wise and otherwise, there's no evidence of inferiority.
The Nazi human experimentation, there's an article on Wikipedia. They list 14 specific human experiments. And one, number three, head injury experiments, I edited that and added that about 10 years ago. Our friend, Martin Small, was a concentration camp survivor. He witnessed this. He wrote about it in his book, very well received, Remember Us. And Martin also signed our personhood petition. Here in Colorado, three times we've gone to the ballot to say that the baby in the womb is a person from the moment of conception. And we were thrilled that Martin put his name to that petition. he's since passed away. So the wickedness of those who believe that we're just animals, it knows no bounds.
Yeah.
There's no bottom to that abyss. If the last question I could ask you, Dr. Bergman, about your book, How Darwinism Corrodes Morality, is about the Japanese sadism during World War II. I bet you a lot of people in the audience don't know about this.
And I didn't know about this at all. And I actually, a number of references that I began looking into pointed out that the Japanese invited a number of well-known Darwinists to lecture at the major universities in Tokyo and in Japan. And they were convinced of the validity of this idea. And they were convinced, of course, as we hear over and over, that the Japanese race was superior. Chinese race was inferior. And the Korean race was inferior and so on. And they treated them so poorly. And, of course, even the Nazis were shocked at the brutal behavior the Japanese rendered against the Chinese, especially at the former capital of China, which is Nanking. And therefore, you know, when the Nazis are shocked, I mean, that's pretty bad. Mm. And for example, what they would do is have contests, how many heads you could cut off of a Chinaman, and they would measure the success by the feet high of the pile of heads were. And now us, we look at that. I have a friend, he's Japanese, and he married this girl who's Chinese, and their families would not accept each other for a while. They did later, but because the Japanese thought the Chinese was inferior and vice versa. And my response is, how in the world can you tell the difference? Because to me, I could tell they're Oriental, but I can't tell whether they're Japanese or Chinese or et cetera. And they say, well, you can if you're Chinese or Japanese. But I couldn't. And they explained to me, and well, this and the eyelids are slightly, and I just couldn't see they were meaningful. But yet they did believe, the Japanese did believe they're the superior race, and therefore they had the right to rule the world. Mm-hmm. And therefore they saw what they were doing as right, as a good thing, to subjugate the Chinese, to kill off as many as you can, and eventually to make the Chinese slaves to the Japanese. The main reason they had for this was, well, we all tend to believe our group is superior, but the other reason they had was that Japan was never successfully invaded by an outsider throughout their whole history. So nobody has ever successfully conquered Japan. So they thought this was clear proof of their superiority. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, World War II ended that. They were invaded and defeated. So this idea, I hope, is now gone, and they realize that there's no superiority of the Japanese compared to the Chinese. But how important Darwinism was really surprised me, and how they worked so hard to indoctrinate the Japanese people in the idea that we're superior, and they applied that in the countries that they took over, and therefore they were brutal. They're brutal beyond what the Germans were.
Well, during World War II, they kidnapped, I mean, officially, they kidnapped thousands of Korean women to force them into service for their male soldiers as prostitutes. I think they apologized for that back maybe 25 years ago.
And if they got pregnant, they killed them because they didn't want to deliver a Mongol, to a child in between Japanese and Chinese. They thought that would be inferior. Mm-hmm. So again, even that rule goes back to the idea of inferiority, that they, you know, the child would not be a superior Japanese. It would be an inferior Japanese-Chinese mixture. And therefore, the girls, if they got pregnant, they had a big problem. I'm not sure how they prevented pregnancy, but that I know at least they aborted the child. They did not want the child born alive.
I think there's a widespread denial in Japan of responsibility for Pearl Harbor and America entering the war in the Pacific.
That's why I understand. Bill O'Reilly's book, I think, Killing the Rising Sun, that was really well done. I thought it did an excellent job. And he covers this as well about the inferiority issue and how important that was in the war between the Japanese and the Chinese and other groups. And that, in fact, in my chapter, I quoted him because he really accurately showed the importance of the problem within a few paragraphs. And so I quoted his statement.
Well, Dr. Bergman, the best place to get your books, I try to buy books from creationist websites because I want to support creation.com, Answers in Genesis, ICR. But Amazon is so easy.
Yeah.
And so going to Amazon, and sometimes I kick myself because I really want to give the money to ICR down in Dallas. But would you say most of your books sell through Amazon?
Yeah, most, not just Amazon, but also Walmart carries them on their website.
Barnes & Noble.
Books A Million carries them. All of the major There's several others. All of the major booksellers online carry my books as far as I know. And I checked, so I know Walmart has them. They don't sell them in the store. They sell them online. So that's, you have to go online.
Right.
Amazon is probably one of the best places, but some people, they just have accounts with Books a Million. And so that's fine if you want to order it through there.
So your last two books, we highly recommend here at Real Science Radio, How Darwinism Corrodes Morality, and then C.S. Lewis, Anti-Darwinist.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for being here.
Well, you're very welcome. So this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams in Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.